Hello, loyal Film Tools podcast listeners. We're excited to announce that we are launching a new podcast in conjunction with our friends over at Pro Video Coalition. The Art of the Cut podcast with Steve Holfish brings candid interviews with some of the top film and TV editors of today into your life. From Oscar and Emmy winners to some of the up-and-coming stars of tomorrow, you can expect in-depth conversations with editors who are shaping the films and shows we'll be talking about for generations. If this sounds interesting to you, make sure to stay tuned for more details in the coming weeks.
I'm Joe Nunez.
Avery Pascal.
I'm Peter Cote.
And I'm Paul McKenna.
And this is a Film Tools podcast. This week's guest, Peter Cote, joins us originally from Michigan. Is that correct?
Yeah, originally from Michigan.
And what are you doing out here in LA now?
I mean, a lot of things. Lately, in recent years, I've been more like freelance DPing. And I feel like I've been moving more into directing DPing. More specifically, I've been trying to do a lot more food work, a lot of tabletop type of food work, but probably even in a smaller niche than that. I mean, I feel like tabletop is a niche in itself, but but I feel like I'm in a niche within that niche, in that I'm doing things that are a lot more specialized, building unique rigs and things like that, focusing a lot on high speed, slow motion type of content. And I feel like I've kind of found that I have a knack for that type of stuff, particularly with directing. And so, yeah, that's kind of what I've been focusing on lately.
Cool. So a couple questions right off the bat that came to mind as you told me about yourself. Where can I see your work?
Instagram is probably the best place.
What's your handle?
So it's just my full name, Peter Cote. It's PeterCote. And so, yeah, that's a good place to see. I mean, my website works as well, and that's just PeterCote.com, okay. Which you can find the link to that on my Instagram. But on Instagram, I post a lot of like behind-the-scenes content and a lot of my work as well. And so there you can get a little bit closer look at what I may be doing currently than my website, which I don't update all the time.
Nice. So I started my career here at Film Tools doing all the product photography, so I'm familiar with tabletop. It is a specialized beast.
Mm-hmm. So is tabletop, as the person in the room who has no knowledge of anything, is tabletop just literally shooting on a tabletop, or is there any, like, is there a nuance to that, or is it kind of...
Not necessarily. No. I mean, most of the stuff that I do doesn't actually exist on a table. But, you know, honestly, I don't know where that name originates from. I just know that that's kind of the category of stuff. I mean, it's a lot of studio type of shooting, it's...
Lots of lighting involved.
A lot of the stuff tends to be more confined probably to a tabletop size of space, I guess. Okay. Is maybe
with a mini psych.
Sure. Yeah, not always though. Like I'm not always using a psych, or probably most of the time I'm not, but sometimes, yeah. I kind of fell into it by accident. I never thought like, oh, this is where I see myself going, like in high school or something like that.
Sure. But, so starting in Michigan, mm-hmm. I know there's definitely some industry there. Obviously you had, you know, the auto industry. So I imagine a number of agencies existed there. When did you sort of start, you know, an interest or find an interest in filmmaking? Was it anything to do with the fact of being in Michigan around those sort of agencies, or is it just an interest of yours in general?
No, I started, you know, in high school, just fooling around like a lot of people do, and that's when my interest in filmmaking first started. But I didn't spend a lot of time in Michigan in the film industry before I came out to California. I went to this like small film school. They had kind of had like a summer program where they were like college courses. I was already in a full-time college student at the time, but there was a separate film program that just had these like little mini courses. And I took one of those over the summer. And through that, I got an opportunity to travel to California for the first time, actually, and work on a feature film. And I was very much like an intern, and I was working for free, super long hours. But it was great. I was gaining a lot of experience doing it. And I basically ended up like working under, like in the grip department and with gaffers as well. And that was like my first experience on like, I guess a quote, real film set. That was out in Palm Springs. And I realized after I did that, because it was a feature film shot over like 3 or 4 weeks. And I thought, I can't do this stuff in Michigan. I wouldn't get the same type of opportunities in Michigan. And so I knew that I had to be out here. So that was what kind of sparked it for me. And then I transferred schools to finish college out in California in an actual film program. And, you know, not everybody goes to film school. I don't think it's necessary for a lot of people, actually. But I did. It was an opportunity for me to meet a lot of people who were like-minded and had the same interests. And that's really probably the most value that I got out of that experience.
For sure. I think, you know, everybody that's been on the podcast basically has said it's all about the networking, right? And there's only a few spots, I think, throughout the country where it's just a hub for filmmaking, production, and having the opportunity to network that way. So I think the move to LA is definitely a good move. It's paid off for you.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, no regrets. So, yeah.
And I could hear people cringing as you were saying, you know, work for exposure, work for experience. But do you think that's a rite of passage? You think that's like one of those necessary evils within the film industry that you don't necessarily, you know, no one's going into nursing school and working for free for, you know, experience or whatever,
I think
right?
It depends on the situation. I mean, no, I'm almost always going to advise people against like working for exposure and things like that. For me at the time, I didn't really see it as working for exposure. I saw it as like, I had almost zero experience at that point, other than like a 4-week, very basic film class at the time. So I had just barely learned some like rules about set etiquette and things like that. And so it was more of an educational experience for me. And I don't have any regrets about working for free in that type of setting, because I had something that I gained from that still. And, but there are a lot of people who already have experience and maybe don't need it as badly as I did at the time. And for those people, I don't advise working for exposure.
Okay.
Almost ever.
Well, I basically have very little to zero experience. So what is set etiquette? What did you learn there? What does that involve?
You know, it's funny because it's hard for me to even like think about that now, because it was new to me then, but those are more instinctual to me now.
Okay.
And I'd have to really think about like, okay, if I were talking to someone who is completely new, I guess the first things that come to mind are, you know, it's important to always be paying attention and listening on set to what's going on, be aware of your surroundings. It's important to understand like some of the department structures and that, understanding where people's jobs start and end. Mm-hmm. Because people get very weird about that type of thing. You know, don't mess with equipment that's not yours. And, I don't know, all this seems like so basic to me now, but, the little film class that I had taken before I started working on that feature a long time ago, they like kind of gave us a one day kind of breakdown on some of those rules. And for the life of me, I can't even remember what they taught us.
I'm sure
the first rule is nobody yells cut but the director. Doesn't matter what's going on. Your camera could be on fire. The director says cut.
Or an assistant director sometimes.
Yeah.
I'm sure so much of it is just like, you know, just built in, baked into your mind now. It's just,
it is, yeah.
It's like, you know, when you sit down at the dinner table, you know how to like know what to do. It's like, how do you even explain what to do when you
sit with down? That, like, I still find myself learning today. Sure. You know, I've been doing this for a long time, and that's a mindset I always try and keep, and I think everyone should. You know, I don't know everything. I'm never going to know everything. And different sets run in different ways too. You work with different directors, different producers, and they have certain things that they, you know, want and don't want. And so sometimes you do have to reacclimate yourself if it's a brand new set and you're not as familiar with the people that you're working with.
Well, tell me about your set. I'm assuming you're the guy running the show, right?
Sometimes it depends if I'm, you know, directing or DPing. I'm a pretty chill person, although I guess there's always moments on set where things get a little stressful, and but I don't think that I'm, you know, I'm not one to yell really, and I'm a person who's probably pretty quick to forgive as well if people make mistakes. I guess, especially with the tabletop stuff, that's a really different pace of shooting compared to a lot of other sets, really. I mean, it's all in studio, and the it's very detail oriented kind of stuff. And so I've also shot a lot of sports stuff, actually. And I probably have a lot more experience shooting sports. Like, I've done a lot for like Nike, Adidas, Under Armour, that kind of thing. And those sets could not be more different than the tabletop stuff that I've done. Especially because when we're working with pro athletes, the window of time that we have with them is a lot of times very short. And so we're not as detail oriented, I guess, because a lot of times it's like, well, I know that take wasn't perfect, but we have only 15 more minutes. And so we have to just call it good enough. And that stuff is sometimes really frustrating. Not that, you know, I totally understand the dynamic of that. But it's very different on a tabletop type of shoot where, it's really important that things look right. They have to, like, if it's food, they have to, has to look appetizing. And there's a lot of, like, I guess I would call it physics involved in some of the stuff that I do, where I'm trying to control things that are very hard to control, whether it be liquids or particles or things like that, and trying to get them to behave. And a lot of times they just don't want to behave.
Where did you learn that wizardry? Because it seems like you have both the science and then the wizardry going on, because I see a lot of weird stuff.
Yeah, you know, I wish I had an answer for that. I feel like it's mostly experimentation. I'm not a trained engineer by any means, but I feel like I have an engineering type of brain. I love to figure things out, and all the rigs and stuff that I've built for these shoots, a lot of it just kind of works its way out in my head somehow.
Right.
And I'm not necessarily like properly trained in all of these things. I'm a person who's figured out a lot of these things by in the age of the internet, which I probably wouldn't have been able to do a lot of this stuff if I were growing up in this industry maybe even 10 or 15 or 20 years earlier. But I learned how to woodwork, and I learned a lot about metalworking and things like that on YouTube. 3 years ago, I didn't even own a power tool, and I had limited experience with them. And now I have probably dozens of them, and I know how to do so many different things. And I'm not a master woodworker, and I'm not a master metalworker or anything like that. But I am more than a beginner, and I know enough to get by and how to do what I need to do.
Well, I think a lot of what maybe your success is attributed to is the ability to problem solve, right? Mm-hmm. If it was as simple as push and record on the camera, I think a lot of people would have the ability to do what you do. Mm-hmm. But it's not that. It's coming up with things. It's, you know, facing a challenge, overcoming it. And that's the secret sauce, you know, because if it was something everybody could do, everybody would be doing it.
Right.
So I'm looking at some of your work, like on Instagram, mm-hmm. and I see the, I don't know if I'm allowed to say the Coca-Cola bottle, but mm-hmm. Coca-Cola bottle, you know, shooting out of the ice or whatever. Mm-hmm. That looks amazing, right? And it's like all air actuated. Looks mm-hmm. like you have a little air deal.
But I love the way he makes it look like it's a little bottle, but he actually cheated, uses a 2-liter.
No, that was only for the one shot.
That was beautiful, inside, but you think right. It's a little bottle.
Right.
But in reality, it's a giant 2-liter just filmed differently.
Right.
Well, it feels, it's like very, it's so practical.
Yes.
Where I think that we spend so much time these days like seeing stuff or watching shows or movies, and it's like, oh, that's all visual effects, like mm-hmm. that's real. And so seeing the behind the scenes of those specific shots, it's like, it's mind-blowing. It's, I found your work through Instagram. That was like originally where I saw you, and consistently I feel like people are like, their minds are blown by like how much engineering seems to go into all of your shots.
And if you didn't show the behind the scenes, nobody would have any idea how you did some of that.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. I tell my wife this, that like people enjoy the behind the scenes more than the actual work.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
But I can't have the behind the scenes unless I do the actual work. Yeah. Otherwise I would only have behind the scenes on Instagram, because that's all people really care about. But you know, it's funny, you were mentioning about how it's not as simple as just pressing record on the camera. Otherwise anybody would do it. But when I post a lot of the behind the scenes stuff on my Instagram, people even then still don't really recognize or appreciate how much problem solving went into getting that final shot. And so I'll have a lot of people comment or send messages, and they'll see something that I did and they'll say, oh, I want to try this now. And that's great. I encourage anybody to try, because I was that person once too, where I was like, oh, I want to try that. But I did very quickly learn, it's not as simple as just seeing someone else's final result. Yeah. For every completed cool shot that you see of mine with behind the scenes on Instagram, probably came with a number of failures before it was ready to show anybody what the full result was.
What about the science of it? Like, how do you make that food look like food when we know that that's oil, or it's not ice, I mean, a cream, lot of it's the mashed stuff, potatoes.
A lot of the stuff that I shoot with it is real food. I mean, there are like some select examples where I may cheat a little bit, but all the Coca-Cola I shot with was real Coca-Cola. The coffee thing that I did, that was all real coffee. You know, like, so I try not to cheat, and that's actually like kind of a fun part of the challenge too.
But you didn't soak those coffee beans so they fell a certain way?
There's a whole other strategy to that, which is it depends on like what I'm working on. Because I do a lot of food stuff and tabletop stuff that's like personal portfolio pieces, where I'm just doing that, and where I don't have a whole crew. But if it's like a real production, real set, real client, real production budget and everything, then there's going to be a food stylist involved in that. And I love to be able to hand that kind of thing off to them. I don't like doing the food styling myself, but for the personal projects, I kind of have to, just because I'm self-funding all of those. But food stylists have so many tricks up their sleeve. I have so much respect for what they do.
And what have you learned?
What have I learned? How hard it is. and
don't eat anything off of a set.
I guess one thing I've learned is, it can be a messy job depending on what you're doing. And that's what makes some of my personal projects so hard, is because I'm messing with food and then my hands are I have to go clean them off before I can go touch anything like my camera or lenses or anything like that. And so when I'm doing those, it's like back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And, just to wash my hands and things like that, and make sure that I'm not getting mess where it shouldn't be. But yeah, it's, uh, the personal projects I learn the most from, because I'm having to do so many jobs that I wouldn't normally be doing. But I think it also makes me better. I think that I'm able to push myself further creatively when I'm doing those personal projects than when I have client projects. I mean, client projects come with their own challenges too, but, sure. I often am most proud to show off my personal projects, just because I had the most control in all of the elements.
So taking a small step back, I suppose.
Sure.
So moving to LA, you had some exposure, in college and came out here to continue and finish college. I saw in your bio that you had worked on The Pacific.
Mm-hmm.
So that seems like a project that there's so much weight behind that, the history behind it. I'm just curious, like, was that, jumping onto a set like that or jumping onto a production like that, how much does that sort of play in as a young, young person within the industry? Is it, how do you approach a project like that?
I was never on set for that project because I worked on that primarily in post, like in visual effects. Mm-hmm. I was working not even for a really long period of time, actually, at a visual effects house. And I was kind of learning as I went, and they were kind of training me at the mm-hmm. same time. It was almost more of like an internship because I was still actually in college.
Okay.
But through that, I did have the opportunity to work on actual shots from projects that they were working on, and that made it into those movies and shows that they were working on. So it was exciting for me at the time. I was young and just excited to be involved in anything that was going to be on that kind of scale. And obviously I was already a big fan of the original Band of Brothers mm-hmm. series. So even having a very, very small part in the new project that they were working on was very exciting for me. But, I was still pretty young then, and I had not a lot of experience. Those were good experiences to learn how like harsh the industry can be in some ways. Because while I was, still at times like working on actual shots from those productions, I was still, making some coffee runs and things like that for, the director or VFX producer or something like that. And, sometimes, just you make one little mistake in those kind of things, and it's very easy for some people in the industry to just want to bite your head off.
Sure.
So that was something I learned about the industry early on, is like, wow, there are some people that, if they have a lot of experience and they can be entitled, and that's the nature of our industry as a whole, sometimes, unfortunately, but it is good to learn those things early on.
Yeah.
If you want to be really careful about what you do and piss anybody off.
So did that experience, working in, the studio environment or, in that production environment, post-production environment, did that push you to want to create your own agency, your own studio? Or was that, what was the in between, from, as a young person in the industry to creating, a studio on your own?
I guess maybe in a small way. I think that when I was younger, like fresh out of college, I knew I was excited about what I was doing, but the traditional path of like working your way up the ladder in the industry, which is still common and a lot of people do it, that felt to me like that's going to take so long before I'm going to be able to get to do the things that I really want to be doing. And it's not that I was like, I'm not above getting coffee for people or things like that, or very basic menial tasks, but, I was just too excited and I wanted to get started now. And so, a friend of mine from college, we kind of started this very small production company initially that was like started in a garage, like the typical story that everyone has.
Those are the best stories.
Yeah. And I mean, I think that we were very naive to do that at the time. A lot of people do this and fail. But we started doing really small projects for not a lot of money. But we did eventually kind of get some really great opportunities for ourselves. And that was mostly through like our hunger and our drive to just create. And that did mean failing along the way too. I think that it's in a lot of success stories, people sometimes forget to talk about like the rough periods that led to what ultimately did work out. But, you know, if there's anybody else out there that's like struggling along the way and you're not really sure, like, you know, about all these bumps you're hitting along the way, like, it's okay. You know, you're not alone in experiencing those. I have, and everyone else that you know probably has too. So,
yeah, sure. We
got an opportunity, what really took off for our company. And this is also what I think eventually led us to, we thought we were going to make movies, narrative features and stuff like that. That was our dream. And, it turns out it's a lot easier to get paid in this industry doing things like commercials and stuff like that. So we started to gravitate more towards that. And we enjoyed it. And it was, you know, definitely a lot easier to like feed ourselves and stay alive. But we had an opportunity to do a project for Levi's. Mm-hmm. And that was really what... Actually, at first we made a spec Levi's commercial just for fun. And we had no intention of sending it to Levi's. It was just like, let's do something that we think is cool and fun. And some people saw it and they're like, oh, this is good. Have you sent this to Levi's? And we're like, no, we're not going to send it to Levi's. And they're like, you should. And so we did. And after, I don't know how many emails and phone calls, someone finally responded back and we were like, oh, actually, this is kind of cool. We don't have a use for this right now, but we had this other thing we're working on. Would you want to pitch on it? And we did. We pitched something which was basically the concept was a guy walking in stop motion from New York to San Francisco in Levi's 50 and their classic 50 and jeans. And I had an idea of how this would be executed, but I didn't really know that we could pull it off. And they loved the idea. They were like, can you show us something? The whole idea of it was very time consuming. It takes a long time to shoot that kind of thing because we had to map out like every single frame. And we did like a 2-second test, which probably took us like a whole day.
Yeah.
Especially because we were still kind of working out how to execute it. And they were like, it wasn't even very good actually. And we sent it to them. They're like, looks great. Okay, let's do it. And that's kind of what started our journey of we actually did the whole trip traveling from New York to San Francisco. We started at the Brooklyn Bridge and ended at the Golden Gate Bridge in San Francisco. And we covered the entire distance. He didn't actually walk the step for step the entire distance because that would be
insane.
I don't know how many hours of even in stop motion sped up, but we did that, and Levi's actually it wasn't officially part of their it wasn't branded as Levi's. It was like a more of a guerrilla like viral video type of thing, just see if this takes off. And fortunately for us, it did. It got really, really big and got millions of views online. And because Levi's was trying to distance themselves from it a little bit still to make it a little bit more covert of a campaign. Yeah,
organic.
They kind of sent all the credit to us as the creators of it. And so that meant that instead of people wanting to interview people at Levi's about the campaign, that meant that, you know, Good Morning America and ABC World News and CNN, all of those calls went to us, and we're like, they wanted to know about how we had done it. And so that was really cool and exciting as a young filmmaker.
Sure.
to have happen. And that kind of big exposure happened very quickly. And that kind of kickstarted our company to be able to work on a lot bigger things with bigger brands and bigger budgets. And so that was really fun to kind of have happen organically. And so,
I mean, it's that sort of marketing that I think people chase nowadays where, mm-hmm. I mean, I've seen the video. I remember seeing it back in the day too. Mm-hmm. As I watched it yesterday, it was like totally sparked in my mind. I was like, I remember this one. But those are the sort of things. I mean, I guess it's sort of a stroke of luck. It's not necessarily like, you know, you guys didn't, you know, you sought it out, but like, I don't know how many people really find success that way, but mm-hmm. I mean, how cool of a story to, you know, make something like that and that be the catalyst too.
Right.
Cause I'm sure that gives you some street credit as you go to, or as other brands come to you, or you go to other brands, or people give your name to brands, where all of a sudden it's like, oh, this person can actually, you know, execute. It's not just
a shot
in the dark.
I mean, that was like a lot of my tabletop stuff. I don't always know exactly how the execution is going to happen mm-hmm. when I pitch something, but I am a good problem solver and I'm a pretty technical person, and that was a very technical project to work on. But yeah, it is a fun experience to be introduced to new people and have them already be familiar with some of my work.
Sure.
I feel like I don't have to work as hard to prove myself at that point because they have some familiarity with what I've already done. And it's a very relaxing feeling for me to know, like, okay, like.
Yeah, well, I'll say you're talking about you're a technical person and a problem solver. There's definitely some creativity because, you know, like I said, I've done tabletop, and that is technical, right? You got to get the light right, the reflections right, all that good stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It's very technical. But I'm looking like at the footage of the coffee beans you have on your Instagram mm-hmm. with the Laowa lens. Is that how you pronounce that?
I don't know if I know the correct pronunciation. I've always been saying Laowa, but Laowa. I don't know.
Telescopic.
It's the one that all the boys were talking about.
Yeah.
So, you know, everybody in the web department here.
Mm-hmm. Those things are blowing up.
Yeah.
I see them everywhere.
They're really hot, right? So everyone's talking about them. They mm-hmm. are cool. You can get some really amazing shots with it, but you got to be creative. Like the coffee bean thing, right? You have like a circular piece of plastic where mm-hmm. you're dumping the coffee beans in them so they'll spiral while the lens is in the middle of them as mm-hmm. they're, you know, gyrating around or whatever. You know, I wouldn't be able to come up with that.
Yeah.
I'm not creative enough to envision doing something like that. So sure, technical, yeah, you got to light those beans right so that you can see what's happening mm-hmm. in there. But the whole concept of actually dropping them in and doing that, the stop motion, right? I mean, there's a lot of camera angles there, more than just, it's not just stop motion. There's mm-hmm. motion within that stop motion.
So yeah.
Camera movement, right?
Yeah. Yeah, that was such a challenging setup, and that is such a fun lens. I know it is blowing up right now, and I mean rightfully so, because it's a really unique lens. It can be a really challenging lens to shoot with because it's wide open aperture is an f/14, and you know most lenses are, if you're shooting with primes like that, you know it's 1.4, 1.8, 2, something like that, To add on top of that, I'm also shooting high speed, so 1,000 frames a second, which most people know requires an enormous amount of light
of lights. That's what I was saying.
So to shoot at 1,000 frames per second and at f/14 it's a nightmare. Like every setup, I'm trying to figure out like how am I going to do this at this frame rate and with this lens. That's such a specialty lens that I'm not using that on a lot of setups,
sure.
But it is the perfect lens for certain setups. And I've actually been so excited about that lens since they first showed it as a prototype like years ago. What I think is so unique about it is especially because there are other probe lenses available out there, but none that come anywhere close to that kind of price point.
Mm-hmm.
It's a great value for what it offers, because if you're looking at other probe lenses out there, like Innovision Optics makes probe lenses. They're based out here in Santa Monica. But if you want to buy, either a used or a new set of something like that, you know, you're looking at $30,000 to $60,000 for a setup. Yeah. They're cool, and they have their advantages too. I think that there are still a lot of times when I would like to use something like the InnoVision optics lenses, partly because they're interchangeable, so you can change your focal length on that kind of thing. But you know, for what is it, $1,500-$1,600 for the Laowa probe? I mean, great.
I think a lot of what's happened in this industry is like Blackmagic coming out with cameras that were super affordable, doing things that, you know, traditionally are done by cameras that are twice that price or three times that price, is what's making it more accessible to the masses, making more people gravitate towards filmmaking. I think it's great. You know, it's just more people with vision actually being able to execute on that. Mm-hmm. But geeking out about cameras, mm-hmm. tell me about the Phantom Flex. I've never got to shoot on one of those.
Yeah, I mean, most people haven't actually. They're so unique, and for most people they are too expensive. And
what's too expensive?
North of six figures. Wow. So, yeah, it's I love shooting high speed stuff. It's so fun. I've had the Phantom Flex 4K for, I don't know, a few years now, and then before that, I had the Phantom Miro as well. I had both of them at the same time for a little while. It's a unique camera system. It's not like shooting on RED. It's not like, I guess the Flex 4K is the closest thing yet to a traditional production camera.
Tell me why. I'm interested in this. I've never heard about
like what makes it different.
And, yeah. Other than the frame rate, obviously.
Yeah. So the company that builds them and makes them, and Vision Research, they're based in New Jersey. They are much more of a like science type of company, as I understand it, than they are like a cinema camera company. I think that a lot of the work that they do is actually a lot of like top secret government type of projects. So from what I've heard, their cinema camera division is just a fraction of their company. And so a lot of what they build is for scientific experiments and military stuff that, so they're not really designing things with like a production model in mind. Mm-hmm. So like their cameras interface more with like Windows and Linux machines than they do with Macs. And like they don't make any software really for Mac, so any software that you use for Phantom type of cameras that's Mac based is more third party developers. And that, because of there are now some third party developers, things are getting better and it's getting easier to use them. But so just as an example, most people are shooting, you know, maybe 24 frames a second most of the time, and it's easy in that they can just hit record, and then when they're done, they can, you know, hit record again to stop. For those that are not familiar with Phantom cameras, it can't do that because the frame rates when you're shooting 1,000 frames a second it's so much data that it's not able to write that kind of data continuously. And so what it has is internal RAM within the camera. It's temporary memory for it to store
to buffer it, basically. Yeah, right,
exactly. So so for example, I can shoot 10 seconds of 1,000 frames per second at 4K, and that will equal about 128 gigs of data.
Jeez.
Insane.
And so yeah, for every 110 seconds of real time that I'm capturing, then it's about roughly 128 gigs of data. And so that's to be able to write that much data in 10 seconds is already really impressive. I mean, find me an SSD that's able to do that, and I don't think you're going to be able to do it. I don't know what they're doing to be able to get those kind of write speeds. But with Phantom, then you have to move that data from the temporary RAM onto the actual card or mag. And So a lot of people are not used to that type of setup. They feel like, because you can watch the shot while it's saved to the temporary memory, but it's not really permanently saved. You don't have that until you move it over and save it to your mag. And so people sometimes that are not as experienced, if they get their hands on a camera like that, they think that if they haven't done their research or anything, then they can really mess up a shoot by
not. You can hit eject. You kind of eject the card right away. Like, let me go ingest this.
I mean, I think there are a lot of people who have been in the industry long enough do have some understanding of that now. But so I'm not always saving the full 10 seconds either, because it's a lot more data efficient and time efficient if I'm only saving the portions of the shot that I really need. Like for some of those coffee bean shots, I might only need second and a half or something like that of the shot. That does save a lot of time and data. But, I think when I'm on set, a lot of the times with other cameras like Alexas or Reds, you know, I can be using the Phantom a lot less, but still produce a lot more data than what those cameras are producing. So,
all right. So tell me about the challenges trying to light that properly. Do you face flicker issues?
Oh yeah.
and that sort of thing, right? So what is it? What are the challenges you've faced? How much of it have you had to overcome on your own? How much of it did YouTube help? You looked it up and somebody else already figured it out. So I guess at the root of my question is, what lights work and what lights you're truly avoiding?
So with Phantom stuff and Flickr and all those kind of things, there's not a lot of help on things like YouTube, because Phantom is still like high speed frame rates like that are still such a niche that there's just not a lot of people out there that are like posting how to videos and tutorials on that kind of thing. I mean, there may be now, but at least when I started getting into it, there wasn't.
Challenge accepted. I mean, buy me a Phantom Flex and I will make some YouTube videos.
I mean, the only one I can think, or the only people are like the slow-mo guys, like Gavin Free. I mean, they do a lot of stuff, but it's all gimmicky, I guess, you know, it's not necessarily. Yeah.
And they're not giving people, they're not teaching them the skills they need to be able to use those cameras themselves. It's just like, look at this thing and look at what it looks like in slow motion. And they're more entertainers.
Sure.
And they do have a good understanding of the camera system, obviously. But getting back to the meat of the question, things like Flickr and what lights, things like that. Yes, lighting is always a challenge with Phantom stuff. It's easier if you're using natural like sunlight, because there's a lot of that and it can be easier to maintain the exposure that you need, and obviously the sun's not going to flicker, which is great.
Hopefully.
But when you're shooting outside, the Flex 4K, for example, doesn't have the same latitude as a camera like Red or an Alexa. So
how many stops of dynamic range? With a realistic, you know, everybody claims, well, 16 stops on my A7. I don't know that I have 16 stops.
Right, I agree. I think it's probably, I've never measured it myself and I've heard varying numbers. I would say it's around like 11 stops, maybe 11 and a half, I don't know, something like that. I can't say for sure. But the thing I'm always looking for with Phantom footage in particular is protecting the highlights as best I can, because it doesn't have that really smooth roll-off curve at the top the way like an Alexa has, which is really beautiful in the way that it kind of clips into, or no, it doesn't really clip exactly on the Alexa, but it just goes to white really smoothly. On Flex 4K, and even before I had that, the Miro, that one clips very quickly to white. The Flex 4K is a little bit smoothed out compared to the Miro, but because I don't want that harsh clip, and I want it to look, you know, I want to preserve all that latitude as best I can, I'm always trying to protect those highlights as best I can. And fortunately, the vision research with the Phantom camera, they do have really nice color science. It can look really beautiful. I actually favor it over a lot of other what supposedly like nicer cinema cameras, it has a very filmic kind of look. Even the noise has kind of a filmic grain type of feel to it, I think. So they've done a great job with that. But when I'm not shooting things like outside with the sun, and I'm having to bring in lights, so yeah, tungsten is safe, but only for much larger fixtures. If the fixture is not large enough, like I generally have found that 2K and above fixtures are safe and are flicker free. Nothing is an absolute rule. I mean, with Phantom, you always need to be checking and looking for flicker, even if you know that the lights should be safe and flicker free. There are so many times when I've come across lights that are supposed to be flicker free and they're not. So that's an important thing to monitor, and it can ruin a shot. And then I do use HMI lights, but they do have to have the high speed ballast, the 1000 Hertz ballast, which mm-hmm. not a lot of rental houses have those. So you're a little bit more limited, especially if you're like not shooting in LA, where the rental houses might not have as wide a selection as here. That can be sometimes an issue. There are a lot of LED lights that are flicker free. Most of them should be, but I always tell people that they probably are not able to dim any of their LED lights at all, because it depends on how the dimming was done in the circuitry of the light. If it's I don't want to get like too technical here, but if it's a voltage-based dimmer on the LED, which is actually not a common way to do it, then voltage-based dimming you should not have flicker for. And the other one, I think, is, I always forget what it's called, I think it's like pulse something modulation, where it's basically turning the light on and off really, really fast, where our eyes can't see that flicker. And it does dim the light to our eyes, but the camera, like if you're shooting 1,000 frames a second, can easily see those on and off.
I just learned something new. I didn't know that was a thing. So that's amazing.
Yeah. And you know, I do love to shoot with LEDs, because another thing that can be a problem with Phantom is the amount of power that you're drawing with a lot of these lights, especially if you're shooting tungsten. I mean, I've done shoots in a studio where I'm using 100,000 watts or more of light. There's not a lot of studios that even have 100,000 watts of light. So that's another thing to consider. Are you shooting at a studio that can handle the amount of power that you need to draw? So that's why LEDs can be a great option, because they're much lower power and they're lower heat.
I was just going to say, not as hot. Yeah. Like, as I'm thinking how nice and cool it is in here compared to outside today. The heat factor on, you know, HMIs, tungsten
especially. So it can get hot on Phantom sets. I prefer to shoot with LEDs when I can, just because it's lower power and lower heat, especially around certain things like food, where heat can sometimes be an issue. Like, you can't shoot ice cream with a, you know, 20K.
Now, tell me, the Coke shoot, was that real ice cubes or was that plastic pieces?
I had both in that, actually. Nice. It depends on the shot. And there might have even been some where they're mixed together. So
so do you typically, when you're going on a shoot and you're going to be like the slow motion capture person, the Phantom person there, mm-hmm. are you bringing your own lights, or is it?
No, not usually. Because, I mean, I do own some lights, and all the stuff that I shoot in my studio, I use my own lights, mm-hmm. but sometimes I'm just barely getting by with the lights that I have. And I just, you need more options when in a lot of environments. I own all 100% LED lights, but it can be a challenge with Phantom stuff, because you need a lot of light to get the right exposure that you're looking for, but you don't always want to. Sometimes to get a lot of light, it's harsh light, and ideally I want a lot of light and also for it to be soft light, and that is hard to do with Phantom. I mean, it's doable, but you know,
that's the secret sauce right there.
You have to have a lot more budget and to be able to have enough light to do that kind of thing. There are a lot of productions that I've run into where maybe it's a stretch for them to even afford to have a Phantom camera in the first place, and they haven't correctly accounted for in their budget that they also need a lot more light. And that's a very frustrating thing to have happen, because a lot of times in those situations, to get the frame rate that we're aiming for, it means that it has to be harsher light, which just doesn't look as naturally beautiful. I mean, there's a time and a place where hard light can be great and nice, but I like to be able to control the light as best I can. I don't want to only have the option for hard light. I want to shoot soft when I want soft and hard when I want hard. So
tell me, what's one of your favorite shots you got with the Phantom? So, you know, with all those challenges, and what's been one of the most, you know, like the hardest one, like it was just, you know, you're pulling your hair out type of challenges, trying to get the Phantom Flex to, you know, behave correctly, or the light, I guess, to behave correctly in order to execute the image.
Well, okay. So lighting wise, the thing in my recent memory, at least, it was that coffee vortex type of shot. That was so hard to pull off, because I was shooting with the probe lens on that one, and I was shooting 1,000 frames a second. So that already meant I need an enormous amount of light. And the subject that I was shooting is dark. So to the dark coffee beans, and unfortunately it was like also a darker roast, so it's darker than average coffee beans. So to be able to get those to show up with any sort of decent exposure was challenging, because I'm also shooting within this like wave type of shape. So I don't have a lot of options for where I can shoot light in from. I'm shooting inside of something, and
you can't shoot straight into the lens.
Well, you can, and I did actually. if you look closely at the behind the scenes, that was the only way I could solve the problem with the lights that I had. Maybe I could have if I had like a 10 or a 20K of my own, then maybe I could have
had angled it
and had it been out of frame, but I don't own one of those. And so I stuck my LED fixture right at the end of that coffee vortex, and I'm shooting directly into it. And it actually worked out really nicely, I think, because it created a kind of a cool little flare that is,
I was going to say, I like the light leak.
Yeah.
So I thought it was angled in, and that's where the light leak was.
That's how I started to try and do it. I wanted to angle it in a little bit more. But I was shooting directly into the light. And even then, I barely got the exposure that I was looking for that shot. And I think I had, in addition to the light that I was shooting directly into, which was, it was an Aidentech jab that I was using. And those are roughly equivalent to like a 1.2K HMI. So, I mean, sure, there's way bigger lights out there than that, but that's, you know, it's not nothing right there to shoot directly into it from like 2.5 feet away. But I had a whole bunch of other lights too, just sticking in there wherever I possibly could. So that was,
well, the shot's beautiful, by the way.
Thank you.
I mean, I love how the light's just getting the edges of the coffee beans, so you know what's happening. I don't think there's any detail lost in there. I don't think it's, you know, all the way black at any point in there.
Mm-hmm.
It's not. I'm looking at it now. It's very well done, and I would have thought it's in at an angle because you're just getting a little bit of that light leak in from like, it looks like off camera, but
yeah,
gets directly in. So
yeah,
good for you.
Thank you. I appreciate it. I was proud of that.
Do those probes have lights on the end of them? I feel like I've seen ones that have like little LEDs.
It has a little LED ring light at the end of it, but which is probably fine if you're shooting things like 24 frames a second, but at 1,000 frames a second, it's just not going to register. Yeah. I don't know what the CRI is on those LEDs. I mean, it's not that I would be against using it, but, I think there have been a couple shots where I've tried to use it, and it's more distracting than anything. There's going to be a time and a place where that is nice and useful to have, but I've actually thought about building my own LED ring light to go on the end of it, something that's stronger but hopefully still really small, and has decent, you know, high CRI LEDs. It would make the front element of the lens just a little bit larger, but it's already so small, I can get away with it being a little bit bigger, and maybe might be nice to have a more custom option at the end of that. So,
all right. So that was, I guess, one of the challenging shots you've done. What about one of your favorite shots?
My favorite shots.
And result, you know, like that's, you're just so proud of it.
I mean, I guess for some people, it's not as sexy and cool as something like that coffee vortex shot, but the ice cream scoop drop that I did earlier this year, that was a hard one to work out. I had a lot of failures leading up to that, and so to finally get it to work, I don't know, like when I did that, because I often just I have a camera just running to on the sides for the behind the scenes, and I was so much in disbelief that it had finally worked. Like in my head I was like screaming, like, you know, oh, I'm so excited, yes. But I was a little bit like dazed for a second, where I was like, okay, that actually worked. And a lot of times I'm running a post trigger on the camera, which means that I have to hit the record button actually at the end of the shot. And I had to like snap back in quickly enough to be like, oh yeah, I have to hit the button to make sure that I captured this. Because there have been a couple times where I get so distracted by all the elements I'm trying to control in a shot that I like forget to do the most important thing, which is hit the button. That's only when I'm like doing like 12 jobs myself in my own studio.
I reposted that one of yours.
Oh,
the ice cream drop. Did it very well. So it's one of my favorites as well.
Yeah, I mean, I love the look, that, you know, high key. The blue is a beautiful blue, by the way.
Thank you.
And then, Joe, we got to find out about the five favorite things before you let them go.
This is true.
We need to know these things.
We will get
there's
there.
People out there waiting.
So, well, let's...
Go ahead.
You ready to transition? Paul always likes to know, what are your five favorite things that you take on set?
Yeah, what can't you live without on set? What do you love?
Okay. I mean, gaff tape for sure. It's so great for everything. I tend to, let me think, like some sort of like multi-tool. A Leatherman. I always have one of those on me, and for the Phantom, this is really nice. There's an app that I often use to control the camera, I can control it from my phone. So I hook up a little router, on like a mini router, on the camera. It connects via Wi-Fi, and that is super, super helpful to have, just so that I can be making adjustments. Like if I could be, if I'm not directing something and I can be with the director, making adjustments on camera while we're looking in the director's monitor, things like that, or saving a shot, I can pick my in and out points with the director and he doesn't have to be right with me next to the camera. So
the app's better than cloning yourself, basically.
Yeah, it's a lot cheaper too. Yeah.
And if you can't wash your hands in between, it's the perfect way. You can always get a new phone.
That's true.
But not a new camera.
Yeah. And then let's see. I don't know, like on a lot of my tabletop stuff, like one of my favorite clamps is our Cardellini clamps.
Oh yeah.
I use them for so many things. So I think that I always have at least a few of those with me, even if I'm not doing anything related to the grip equipment that's already there. And then maybe I don't know, like my innovative cart, I guess.
Sure.
I love that. The innovative makes such great carts in there.
Which one do you have?
I have the Scout 42, which is a little bigger than what most people use. I think a lot of people have the 37s.
Yeah.
I find it nice to have just a little bit of that extra space because for Phantom stuff, sometimes I'm managing that data as well, and so I'm having to do camera stuff and stuff on like my iMac Pro or something like that, and so to be able to have space to have computer and drives and then also some room for some camera stuff, it's like I'm not just like a DIT where I've got a cart just of DIT stuff and not just a camera PC guy cart. Who has a cart for camera stuff only. I kind of have a mixed cart of both worlds.
I want to see pictures of it now because it's a hybrid.
Yeah.
What kind of drives do you use?
Well, when I can, I almost always want to have rated drives because the data rate of the stuff that I do is so high that it'll be too much of a bottleneck to have like single spinning disk drives. So I want something that's at least 400 megabytes a second write speed.
Mm-hmm.
I always have on set an SSD RAID, like a RAID 0, so I'm usually getting like around at peak like a gigabyte a second of read-write speed, and which is really nice to have. So yeah, I have to have really fast drives.
That's what I was asking.
Otherwise, I'd be working overtime on a lot of sets just trying to save everything and back it up at the end of the day.
How much storage are you bringing with you?
It varies, like, because some shoots I do, it's such a niche camera that I might only have like one shot for the whole day on Phantom. And, so for that small, but if it's like a serious Phantom day where we're doing quite a bit of stuff, I like to have, around 4 terabytes for like one single copy of data. So, it's rare that I go over 4 terabytes. It's usually somewhere between like 2 to 3 terabytes for the day. But I don't know. I mean,
everyone talks about that. It's that 2.5 terabytes is like the sweet spot for storage, but they don't make a 2.5 terabyte drive.
Right? I mean, it may be the sweet spot, but I would still get at least a 3 terabyte.
Mm-hmm.
Or I, most of the time I get like a 4 terabyte because you never know if maybe I use 2.5 terabytes a lot of the time, that's not going to suit me very well the day I have 2.6 terabytes of footage.
Sure.
So, I want to make sure I've got more than enough. So
I think we're getting kind of close to our time. So I'm curious to know, what are you working on now? Or is it a lot of, you know, high speed, motion capture? Is it, you know, are you still doing a lot of commercial stuff? What are you sort of gravitating towards and what are you hoping to do in the future?
I'm doing a lot of commercial stuff still. I'm still kind of new actually in this tabletop type of food niche space. So I feel like I'm still establishing myself in that. And, with that, I would love to move towards actually being represented as a tabletop director.
Okay.
So you're embracing your niche.
Yeah. I mean, people that have known me for a long time, they say that this suits me so well because it just checks so many of the things that line up with my personality. So that's something that I would love to be doing more exclusively is tabletop. Maybe not always food stuff, but I do love the food stuff in particular. So in the next couple of years, I hope to be doing that a lot more exclusively and a lot of motion control stuff. You know, I love using things like the Bolt high speed arm or robot. I forget what were the other parts of your question there.
Well, I guess, so that's what you're doing now. It's like the immediate future.
Mm-hmm.
Are you still looking to do narrative stuff? Is that like still a goal of yours, or are you thinking that, you know, commercial is the way and the spot that you want to live in for a bit?
I would be open to doing narrative stuff. I've put such little focus on that though in recent years, so it's not something that I feel like is really pressing. Like I do enjoy narrative type of work, but I just don't think that that's something I'm putting a lot of attention towards right now. I mean, for the right opportunity, if it were to come along, like, sure, yeah. But I've also learned that, I don't know, some people just want to do narrative stuff badly enough that they'll just do anything that comes their way. And I want to make sure that there's a lot of bad narrative stuff out there too. Yeah. And I wouldn't want to get involved with something just to be doing narrative. Mm-hmm. I want to make sure that it's a project that is like worthy of my time and that I feel like I can be proud of after I've done it. Probably not going to be doing a whole lot of narrative stuff. Maybe like short form narratives, would be better because it's a lower time commitment.
I just can't imagine there are a lot of people who are doing, you know, phantom capture. Like, I don't know if there are.
I don't do, like, a lot of people know me as a person who only does phantom stuff, and I don't only do phantom stuff, but I have developed, I guess, a bit of a reputation around that.
I mean, you're super knowledgeable about it. So, I mean, the way you speak of it is just, it's a science in itself, so.
Yeah, I mean, I would consider myself an expert with phantom stuff, but, there's not a lot of high speed stuff in narrative type of content.
Well, outside of the Phantom, what do you like shooting on?
Alexa is great. I guess I'm not picky. Like, it just depends on this scenario. Like, I mean, I haven't shot on it yet, but I would even shoot on the new Blackmagic pocket camera. I think is like so cool. Like, it's got really great latitude and it seems like the color science is really pretty. I've seen some great skin tones come out of those images. But that doesn't mean I would use that on anything. It just depends on, like, you know, if it were like more doc style or something that had to be like a quicker type of production, that could be really nice for certain things. I've shoot on Red, I'll shoot on Alexa.
Mini LF, man. I'm really digging that thing.
Yeah, you know, I'm not like, I know a lot of people are really excited about that. And I was at first, but I've come down from that a little bit now.
Tell me why.
I think that, I don't know, like I don't always need that bigger sensor. It's great and it's beautiful for certain things. I'm more excited for when Arri is going to release the mini, like, Super 35 4K version. I think that that's actually going to be a bigger camera in the long run, potentially.
Okay.
Like, I don't think that everybody needs to shoot full frame. I haven't shot on the mini LF, but I certainly would. Maybe if I were to do a shoot on it, maybe I would be hooked, but I don't feel like a draw to it where I'm like, oh, like I have to use that, and that has to be a regular part of my camera experience. So I don't know, there's a time and a place where, like, that's the right tool for the job
for sure.
And I know a lot of people love it and are super excited about it, and I think that it's hard to go too wrong investing in Arri. I don't necessarily feel the same way about Red, but...
I'll defend Red, not that I'm a Red fanboy, but my thing with Red now is the way they're working their bodies is you can invest in the Super 35mm sensor now, if I'm understanding this correctly, and then you can always upgrade it now to the, Dragon sensor? The 8K sensor that's on the Monstro?
It's not Dragon. Dragon's a few years old now.
Okay.
I don't know. I mean, I'm
helium
not
helium sensor.
Helium, yeah.
Yes.
My thing with Red is, I mean, they're beautiful cameras and everything, and I do shoot on them. I think it's harder to invest in Red just because, yes, you can do those upgrades, but it's like any time a new upgrade becomes available, like you kind of have to do it because everyone wants to be shooting on the latest thing. And so, you know, sure, you spend however much up front and then another year or sometimes less or more than a year, like depending on when you bought the camera, you know, you kind of have to invest in something again just to like keep the camera current. At least if you're like, it depends on like if you are the one that gets to make that call of like what camera is going to be used, like, then if it were always up to me, yeah, I wouldn't always need the latest sensor, even though it's nice to have that. And then I wouldn't feel like, oh, I have to upgrade. I don't know. I used to own a Red. I invested pretty early on, and you know, I did pretty well with that camera, but that's also because I wasn't really relying too much on the rental market to make my money back, and I did make my money back on it. But I know a lot of people nowadays are hoping to make their money back through rentals, mm-hmm. at least in part. And I don't think a lot of those people are doing very well with that. So they're great cameras. I have nothing against them. I just don't think that that's something I would invest in. I think that the life cycles of Arris are a little bit longer.
I would agree.
And so for that reason alone, I feel like it's a better investment, not necessarily because, you know, one camera system is better or worse. Everyone's got their preferences, obviously, but yeah.
All right. Interesting. Fair enough.
Well, thank you for coming on. This is, I think there's a lot more to unpack and in future iterations. Hopefully we can have you back on.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. I love it.
Talk about what you're working on. This is our last episode of this season, season 1, episode 8. So we're stoked to have you on as our last guest for the season. And
thank you.
We're going to take a little bit of a break for a couple of weeks.
It's a good way to end the first season, I think, for sure.
The season finale, the big climax.
Yeah. You didn't disappoint. I mean, honestly, it was a really interesting conversation. And as someone who doesn't have a lot of product knowledge and a lot of understanding, I think it's just fascinating to hear about, you know, living in that space of you know, what you do and how you've become successful. So it's really cool. Thank you for coming on.
Yeah, well, thank you.
Thank you. So on behalf of Paul,
yes.
Peter, and John, no, Avery, this is Joe. And this is the Film Tools Podcast. Thanks for listening.
Thanks, guys.